Well, good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. And this will be the closing session on, I think, what we'll all agree is a marvellous day of commemoration and indeed celebration of the 1916 Rising. Now, just one or two things. We're not going to be mic'd up here. I think you can probably hear fairly well. It's a good room for acoustics. We do have a radio mic for audience participation. And just to make clear, in case you haven't been at a head school before, if you're expecting to come here and relax and be entertained, you know, that's not the way it is. You're supposed to do some work and get involved in the discussion, and you'll be given ample opportunity later on. I'd also like to welcome a film crew from Griffith College, some of my Griffith College students up there. So this has been filmed and it's being recorded, so don't say anything libelous, please, in the later discussion. Our topic for discussion here today is Dublin, Easter 1916, what was it like? What we're trying to do here is to give you some impression of what it was like on the ground, for either from the rebel point of view, from the point of view of civilians, etc. Now, we have assembled a panel, some of whom you may find are slightly out of breath because they've been sort of multi-locating all around the city. John Gibney, first of all, I'd like to introduce, of Trinity College and the Glasnevin Trust. And then beside me, Mary McAuliffe of Women's Studies UCD. And then to my right, Lucy McDermott of Montclair University, New Jersey. And then on the right, Joe Connell, broadcaster and author. Now, all of these people have published numerous titles, too many to mention all individually. But to save you time, if you don't have time you don't know which one to pick, they are all contributors to our 1916 supplement, which Tommy very generously mentioned. By the way, I'd like to say a word of apology to Tommy, because he may have noticed some unkind stuff on the internet over the years condemning Tommy Gorman, when in fact it was really Tommy Graham they were getting at. Mary, I'd just like to go to you first. Just give us some basic idea of the city of Dublin. You know, how many people lived here? Where did they live? And then how that intersected, if you like, with the rebellion as it unfolded.
Well, of course, the rebellion takes part in the most densely populated part of the city, right in the centre. That part of the city had been the glorious Georgian city of the 18th century, but through the 19th century had now become the tenements. North and south, inner city Dublin, have become the tenements. But it's extremely densely populated. Beginning a bit like today now, people are moving back into the city. They're living in the old Georgian and Victorian and Edwardian houses. You have maybe a family per room. In some houses, you might have 100 people. The middle classes have moved out into suburbia. So they're living in Rathmines, Ranelagh, Rathgar, Clontarf, up the North Circular Road and the South Circular Road, in that circle around the city.
What's the population overall, roughly?
It's about 200,000-250,000. Of course, the population of Ireland at the time isn't very big, because after the famine, the population starts declining from that 8 million height, so that it's about 4 million altogether in 1911. And by 1916, it's about that.
Okay, John, in your 1916 in 50 Objects, you do a little piece on the press coverage, right? So give us a flavour of the press coverage on the morning, just before the rising breaks out.
Okay, well, I'm just going to have recourse to what's obviously the finest book ever written on the subject. But I want to give you just a flavour of what kind of things Dubliners woke up to in the newspapers that day. And a newspaper isn't indicative of what people actually would have thought. You know, they're imperfect sources, but it's a reflection of at least some concerns, and things at the Easter Rising were conspicuously absent. We'll take the Irish Times for a moment, okay, in which its coverage on that morning was dominated by the war. The Battle of Verdun, list of the Irish casualties, German fears of a British offensive at Ypres, a charity rugby match to raise funds for injured soldiers between the Crocs of Leinster and the Crocs of Ulster. Ex-internationals and the Crocs of Ulster won. Ferry house races, rather important to an Irish audience. A new run of Kathleen Ni Houlihan. There was the Easter message of John Bernard, the Anglican Archbishop of Dublin, who was also a fellow of this university, who spoke on Easter Sunday in Christchurch of, quote, "the conquest of evil, the conquest of death. This is a conviction, the faith that right must conquer might, with which our armies go forth, with which we send them. The Easter message is a message of victory. but it tells of a victory that always came through tears and blood. So it always is in the Crusades of Earth, for the disciple is not above his master. On one level, that indicates that the rhetoric of sacrifice wasn't confined to Patrick Pearse. It also reflects a simple human tragedy that his son had been killed at Gallipoli the previous year. Now, in the Irish Times, in the letters pages, a man who called himself an Irish nationalist complained that, he said conscription ought to be extended to Ireland, because why should the Irish be let off the hook if the Scots and the Welsh were going to get roped into the British army? And as he put it himself, I quote, "Why should Irishmen suffer the indignity of allowing other countries to sacrifice everything for our sakes, while our foolish young men play at soldiers in the streets of our cities and the roads and lanes of our country districts?" You could probably guess who he was talking about there. And what happened over the next few days may have changed his mind. The Freeman's Journal and The Independent covered quite a lot of the same things. In the Indo, you could learn about a vice-regal tour of Ulster, golf, a remarkable honest offer to get a suit from London at a knockdown price, fighting at Verdun, eat the Caucasus, Mesopotamia, the annual convention of the GAA, complaints that, or assurances that those profiteering by adulterating foodstuff during the war at time of shortage would soon face stiffer penalties, and you finally get fragments of something else. And that something else is a report that, it's a report of the recovery of three bodies from Castlemaine Harbour in County Kerry, allegedly wearing, I quote, Sinn Féin badges, and the capture of a boat with weapons in Kerry, and how, I quote, a stranger of unknown nationality was arrested in the vicinity as in detained in custody. That was presumably Roger Caseman. So there may be fragments of the Rising, or what may yet become the Rising, but it should be obvious from all that the concerns that people were faced with in the morning of the 24th of April 1916 were rather different to what you might automatically assume.
Joe, I'll go to you now for the rebels, right? So just give us an idea, what time did they sort of step out? How long did it take them to occupy the various positions? And, in very quick terms, like about 2 minutes, what were those positions? How many of them were there, for example?
Well, remember that the countermanding order had come out on Sunday, so a great many of them stayed home on Monday morning. The mobilization orders went out on Monday morning. Late in Monday morning, they started assembling at Liberty Hall and the other areas, Blackhaw Place for those in the Four Courts area. They basically had gone to their assignments somewhere the late Monday morning and early Monday afternoon. There were people in the Four Courts area, there were people in the South Dublin Union area, there were people in City Hall, there were people, of course, in the GPO, there were people in the Stevens Green area, and there were people in the Jacobs Biscuit Factory, which is now DIT. So they were all around the city. The women were also affected in terms of mobilization. Some of them went around on Monday morning trying to find a place to go. They couldn't find necessarily the places to which they were assigned. And sometimes they went to areas where they were not assigned, but they were taken into the garrisons, with the exception of De Valera, of course, who was in Boland's Mills with the 3rd Battalion, where you didn't have any women there. The Citizen Army women were primarily either in St. Stephen's Green or in the City Hall. There were a few in GPO, but basically there were those two garrisons.
By the way, I was at a previous talk this afternoon. I was told De Valera regretted that decision because he said he had to spare too many good men to do the cooking. Tempted to ask a question, was there any casualties as a result of the cooking by the men in Boland's Mills, but I decided not to. Mary, Joe has mentioned women there, and there's no doubt that the women are now front and centre of the whole commemoration. You've got some interesting stories in your book about the lengths to which they would go to get involved.
You met Lucy.
Lucy.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
In the back? Okay. Yeah, I'm going to tell you about three women, and I'm interested in my book, At Home in the Revolution, in quite literally how did the women get into the garrisons. Some of you may have heard three times today because I said it too, De Valera didn't allow them. So De Valera and Boland's Mills had a policy. The Citizen Army at Stevens Green and the College of Surgeons also had a policy. Women were allowed. The garrisons that interested me were the ones that had no policy at all because they had to figure it out on the spot. And many women, as Joe was just saying, there was a lot of confusion in the mobilization orders for the men. There was even more for the women. And I'm going to tell you about three of them. Kate Byrne is the one who made the most dramatic entrance to a garrison. She was out walking with her sister Alice. She went home, and her mother said, "Your brothers have already gone out. They're out. The scrap is beginning. Get your kit and go." And so her mother pretty much pushed her out the door to join the Rising. She got to O'Connell Street, she saw a battalion of volunteers marching, and she says, "I fell in behind." And then Michael Staines, who was leading them, said, "Right turn." The volunteers made the right turn, and Kate, who was a member of Kumanaman, also made the right turn. right into the GPO where she was stopped. She was at the end, the volunteers all got in, and Michael Sain said she couldn't go in, and then he said one of my favorite lines of 1916, "I'll tell Patty on you." Patty was her brother, and she wasn't deterred by that. She just waited around, and she saw that although the windows in the front of the GPO had been broken and they had sandbags in front of them, there were windows on the side that hadn't been kicked in. So she waited around to find two volunteers she knew, and they hoisted her up, and she kicked in the glass, and then she jumped in. And she landed on top of a volunteer named Joe Gahan, who said to her, "How the bloody hell did, what the bloody hell are you doing here?" is what he said to her. And he then pointed out to her that she was bleeding, because if you jump through, if you kick out the glass, you might not get all the stuff on the edges. So she was bleeding, and she hadn't even noticed that. And then a volunteer, I think named Leon Clark, blew himself up slightly with an explosive, and he said to her, "Here's your first case." So there was actually something for her to do. I'll tell you about another negotiation at the threshold of a garrison where women were trying to get in singly and having trouble or not knowing what to do. Min Ryan, who was the girlfriend and pretty much the intended wife of Sean McDermott, had been working in four courts in the morning, and Ned Daly said, "Go home and wait for further instructions," which is never said to the men. They're always given something to do. So Min Ryan went toward the GPO because she wanted to see Sean McDermott, but she didn't think she could just go in. And she met Sean T. O'Kelly, who was later her brother-in-law, later president of Ireland. At that moment, he said, "Would you like to go to the GPO? Would you like to see Sean McDermott?" Because he knew what her motivation was. So he took her into the GPO. So already she has to have a mediated access, right? She doesn't just go in. She waits for Sean T. O'Kelly to help her in. Then he introduces her. How much more time?
Just clarification. Is you saying then she went because she fancied Sean McDermott?
Right.
Okay.
She wanted to see him. They were girlfriend and boyfriend. They, you know, she was used to it. They would sit around Bewley's, as she says that in one of her statements. You know, because when she was saying goodbye to him in Kilmainham, she said it was as if we were in Bewley. So she's used to that. But the Rising has changed the rules of engagement. She can't just walk into the GPO and say, "Hi, Sean, here I am." So Sean T. O'Kelly leads her in, and he leaves her with, he introduces her to Connolly, and Connolly goes off to do something. She's by herself in the GPO, and she says, "I felt like the perfect camp follower." She doesn't know what she's doing there. And then she says this to Geroid O'Sullivan, "I would like to see Sean McDermott." And he says, "You can't see him. He's resting now." And she goes home. And so there are two people between her and Sean McDermott. The things have changed, and she really has no reason to be in the GPO, and she leaves. She goes back the next day and is given things to do. I will tell you about a third, again, a kind of solo entry into a garrison that is completely different, and that's a woman named Leslie Price, later Mrs. Tom Barry. Leslie Price, like Min Ryan, was working in the four courts early in the morning. Ned Daly says, "Go home and wait further instructions." She, too, does not go home and wait further instructions. And I'm going to read you what she says because it's interesting. It sounds as if it was very easy for her, but it quite. She says, "You know the volunteers, the kind of men they were. They thought we should be away from all that danger. However, this was where I showed lack of discipline. Breed Dixon and I decided that we were not going home. Here was something that would never happen in our lives again. We decided to go down to the center of the city, see what was going on, and get into any building that was available. Breed and I walked down O'Connell Street and went into the post office." They just went in. "There we saw Sean McDermott, Tom Clark, Sean McGarry, Gerard O'Sullivan, Michael Staines, and all the people we knew in the Gaelic League, and we flew over to them." So all the people who have been barriers to the other two women that I mentioned, she just said, "We saw them." She walks right in. When I first read that, I thought it was easy for her. But then I read again, and she begins, "You know the volunteers, the kind of men they were. They thought we should be away from all that danger. This is where I showed lack of discipline." So she has to talk herself into the courage to go in. So what you can see, it's different. When you come in with a whole group of commandement, then that was fine. But coming in singly, there were always these little obstacles for women.
Mary, I just want to talk a little bit about the civilian population, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And probably less dramatic. Well, probably slightly less dramatic, like the day-to-day lives. I mean, how was that affected? The city is occupied by rebel force. Pretty soon there's going to be a British cordon around it. So what was it like? I mean, what always strikes me about this thing about, say, the women's role, people say, they were just making the sandwiches in the GPO, but, like, getting a sandwich and, getting fed, in this period was quite a task.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if you read the witness statements and the pension application files, food is an obsession with a lot of them, because they have come, most of the garrisons, particularly like Stephen's Green and the Royal College of Surgeons, have come unprepared to spend days and days in a garrison. And when they retreated to the Royal College of Surgeons, for example, they found loads of specimens in formaldehyde, but there was no food in the garrison, so they were...
you just raised a terrible thought there. Now.
They didn't eat that.
They weren't that desperate.
The people who are doing the foraging for food are the women. Where they have supplies, where they've brought supplies with them, the women are setting up their food stations and they're producing the food. But then, people say, oh, they did only make the food. But then they have to take the food, not just to the garrison, but to the outposts that are situated around. So if you take O'Connell Street, they didn't take just the GPO. They took Rhys's Chambers, they took the Imperial Hotel, they took various other outposts around. So all those outposts have to be fed. For example, when one of the Cumann na mBan women goes to Rhys's Chambers, the volunteers there threw their arms around her because they were so delighted. They were starving. They'd eaten their rations in the first few hours, and now they'd had no food for about 24 hours. And some of the women talk about making those journeys over and back. In the College of Surgeons, Nellie Gifford has to go out foraging for food, and they have to go over to Jacob's Factory, where they bring back crackers.
Well, there's plenty of biscuits and cream crackers.
Tell me this,
Mary, how did the rebels then distinguish between who was one of their own foragers and someone who was a looter?
I think it was probably pretty difficult, particularly as, other than the Irish volunteers themselves, nobody was in uniform. What the women say, that they left notes in shops they went into where they took some food. They left IOUs. How they thought they were going to pay for it afterwards, I don't know, but they left a little note saying for the Republic of Ireland. The looters, you have to realise that inner city Dublin was a densely packed area. Most of the people living there were living day to day. They would buy their food. They didn't have fridges and things like that. So access to shops became a problem, even if you weren't a looter, actually getting food. And in those who left diaries, the civilians who left diaries, most of those now are not the working class people living in the inner city. But even in the suburbs, by Tuesday or Wednesday, certainly by Wednesday or Thursday, they're talking about a shortage of bread, shops being either closed down or most of the provisions have been bought out. So there's a real sense that food provisioning is short. Also, as the army begins to tighten its grip around the city, it's harder to move around. You have to go through barricades. There is a danger you could be considered a combatant and shot. Civilians are shot both by the British Army and by the rebels for all sorts of different reasons, either accidentally or because they're looting or for other reasons. So it becomes a very dangerous situation just to carry out the day-to-day living. Of what people are doing.
John, you were coming in on that?
It's just on the food thing, because, once or twice, whatever we're foraging for food, sometimes food might actually come to the volunteers. Like, I was in the forecourts earlier, and apparently in the greens in the forecourts at one stage, a goat wandered in. Mm-hmm. Some member coming along ended up milking the goat, getting a little milk supply. And as well as that, the intensity of fighting varied from garrison to garrison. And up in Marrowbone Lane, where the Jemison distillery was seized, one of a number of distilleries, though the produce was not touched by the volunteers, it should be said,
Except
for medicine, yeah. But there was some lad was apparently driving three cows down Cork Street, and he kind of figured that they could come in handy. And they went out, literally took the cows, got them into, the distillery. There was a guy called Bob Holland who turned out to be an apprentice butcher. He was given the job of chopping them up, though he got none to meet himself. And he later recorded that Con Colbert, who was in the garrison, inquired about turning the hides into moccasins, which is an interesting reflection on how busy they were. Now, the thing is, though, you can't underestimate the disruption. Because even aside from the politics of the rising, life was turned upside down in the city. I mean, Oscar Traynor, when he was being marched down O'Connell Street, recorded someone shouting at him, "Starvers at the people." that, I mean, the very fact that food supplies were disrupted, you know, it's a fairly fundamental issue for people, you know, and added to the hostility that the volunteers were undoubtedly faced with.
And plus the fact that the money for the women whose husbands and brothers and sons and whatever were fighting on the Western Front used to come in through the post offices.
Right.
And so now the main post office is taken over. You don't have money to buy whatever. Of course, in any time of war, the price of food began to shoot up very, very quickly. Somebody always benefits. And so they had no money.
Lucy.
Yeah, what I heard about Marylebone Lane Distillery, two things. First of all, I heard that they only got one cow.
No, they got three.
They got three.
And a few chickens.
And a few
chickens.
Yeah,
well, the chickens. But the man, there was one cow left, and the guy was looking for it. Right. I mean, the man who had been driving the cows didn't see the volunteers take them. And he was looking, he couldn't figure out how cows could disappear that easily, and he couldn't figure out where they'd gone. But the chickens were on their way to the Viceroy. Yeah. And they took them off from the little boy on the bicycle who was bringing the chickens, and I think they said, give our compliments to the Viceroy or something like that.
And actually, at the Marlborough Lane Distillery as well, Mrs. Seamus Murphy, Kathleen Murphy, turned up heavily pregnant and took over the job of cook, and apparently she was a fantastic cook, and they were all delighted with the food she was producing during the week, and it was actually some of the best food many of them had had.
Joe, can I just go to you? From the point of view of the British Army, right? I mean, did they face any of these logistical problems, or can we assume that you know, food and things like that wasn't a problem for them?
Well, they faced some logistical problems, but not the same kind of ones that the right. volunteers did. For certainly, they didn't have any difficulty going out commandeering food all the time and foraging for food and that sort of a thing. Logistically, the volunteers simply weren't prepared for the rising in just about any way whatsoever. I talked to a man many, many, many years ago before I even started writing, but a man by the name of John O'Callaghan, who said it went out that morning to St. Stephen's Green, put his sandwiches in one pocket, he had some shells for his house Mauser in the other pocket, put his gun underneath his coat, and went out to take on the British Empire. And I think that kind of sums up the logistic aspects of the volunteers.
Joe, this is something that's increasingly intrigues me, right, because that gives the impression, you know, a guy who puts a sandwich, you know, in one pocket, gun under a coat, that this is an amateur going out to take on a professional army. But was it actually like that? Because it seems to me that in many respects the insurgents were better trained than the British Army people they were to face in combat.
Well, first of all, you must remember that a great many of the British people who came over here, the reinforcements who were over here, certainly those at Mount Street Bridge, South Staffs, and that sort of thing, these were all brand new soldiers. They've been in harness for 6 weeks and that sort of thing. And in those days, what they did was they would do an awful lot of marching and drilling. Again, armies have a tendency to always fight the last war. I mean, there's no particular reason to do marching and drilling when you're going to go out into the trenches in France. That doesn't really make an awful lot of sense. And they hadn't really trained on their weapons. They got off the vessels there in, at that time it was called Kingstown Dunleary. They marched them out, marched the British out onto the piers, told them to load their weapons and fire them out to sea, figuring they probably couldn't hurt too many people that way. That sort of thing. Then they marched right up Northumberland Road to Mount Street Bridge, and they were decimated. So at that point, yes, you're absolutely right. The volunteers were much better prepared. If you go to the various garrisons, you go around to Sean Houston and the Mendicity Institute, that's just a classic ambush. That ambush could be taught, as I've said so many times before, that ambush could be taught at West Point or Sandhurst today. It was brilliantly done, brilliantly set up, and they did a very good job of it. So on an overall strategic level, I think the plan was mad. It really almost didn't exist at all. But when you get lower down, you get into what Ned Daly did in the 1st Battalion around the forecourt. So you look at some of the individuals, they were very, very good, and they were very well trained.
So at micro level, you're saying they performed quite well. Okay. I mean, if we just step back a little bit here.
Urban tactics were quite good, and they've been looking at urban tactics. James Connolly been lecturing them on urban tactics for years. And realistically, people in warfare, it's all the same. You know, with a military background, I can speak to this a little bit. The weapons change daily. The weapons today are so much different than they were then. But an awful lot of the tactics are the same now as they were back in Sun Tzu's time, 3,000 years ago. And if you're going to have a siege of Fallujah, for example, today would be following the very same principles as a medieval army siege.
What do we know about the motivations or the attitudes of, you know, the ordinary Tommy, the British soldier? You know, I mean, some of them, you hear stories that they expected to be landing in France. I mean, how well prepared or badly prepared were they?
They were not prepared to come here at all, but nor were the officers prepared to come here at all. And again, the ones that got off the vessel there, very often the officers went across to the St. George's Yacht Club and had breakfast, and the Tommies leaned against the wall and ate some bully beef or something like this. I mean, they were simply not prepared at all. You do hear stories of... And I don't know how apocryphal these are, quite frankly. You hear stories of them marching into town and women walking out with tea and biscuits. And That might be true. I really don't know. I can't quite imagine some of the women out there who probably had never picked up a teapot in their life, except to, you know, to talk to the viceroy or something else, running out there with a couple of cups and saying, here, you know, to something else. But in any case, they simply did not. You also hear the stories about the ladies going out and talk to them, and they addressing them as mademoiselle because they thought they were in Paris or something. There's probably a lot of apocryphy in those stories, but certainly they did not know they were coming to fight here, and they did not, that the officers, of course, were either half-pay officers who went back on duty and or were new themselves. So the British Army coming in was not very well prepared at all.
Does it maybe show up, I saw you in the second, Mary, maybe one lacuna in the whole explosion of sources, that we're still a bit light on maybe rank-and-file British Army sources, but what?
Actually, there are sources that show that, right, that they were making the sandwiches for the British Army file. If you look at the diary of Mrs. Mary Martin, whose son Charlie had just gone missing in around January in the Western Front, and she starts a diary give him, she presumes he will be found and he'll be alive, so she can bring up to date what was happening on the home front. And she talks about the week of the rebellion, and she sees the soldiers marching in from Dunleary, and of course they remind her of her son, and she does talk about giving them sandwiches and giving them tea. There's another letter from a woman who lived on Northumberland Road, whose cousin was in the Royal College of Surgeons, so it's now in the Royal College of Surgeons archive, whose house was taken over by the squaddies, and she fed them while they were in her house. Like, she is supportive, she's against the rising, the Sinn Féin rising, as she calls it. And indeed, Sheila Humphreys, whose family, niece of the O'Reilly, who's living on Northumberland Road and witnesses the Battle of Mount Street Bridge, actually, even though she's a supporting of the rising, her brother, Dick, who's in his late teens, is in the GPO with the O'Reilly, feels some empathy for them. She says, I see them, they're the cannon fodder of empire. They're being thrown into this fight. They don't know how to hold their guns. Indeed, their officers talk about the fact that he had to show them how to shoot the rifles. So a lot of the evidence we have is actually beginning to match up with the stories we've been told, you know, that they were unprepared and that there were members of the Dublin public who were supportive of them.
Can I add one little thing to that, to what Mary said? When the British soldiers were in the Humphreys kitchen, also the Sheila said something to her little brother, and one of the soldiers said, they speak English. And I think that supports, again, the idea that they thought they were in France and were very surprised to be surrounded by English speakers.
It reminds me, I got a bit of spam this morning from some ball bearing maker in China, and it was translated in perfect Irish. At the bottom. God help them, you know. John, I wonder, I'm very conscious about our venue here in Trinity College, right? So what's happening in Trinity College in 1916?
Well, in some ways, the college here is one of the great overlooked locations of the rebellion, because as the Irish Times put it afterwards, Trinity College had, I quote, stayed true to its traditions. And it's worth bearing in mind what traditions they actually were. In 1912, the college had about 1,400 students. Over 60% of them would have been members of the Church of Ireland. So you were talking about politically, the students and staff would have been very heavily weighted towards unionism. And after, who was one of the sitting MPs for the university in 1916? Edward Carson, the unionist leader, you know. So when the rebellion broke out, the college was secured by its porters. The gates were locked and so forth. And apparently, for some reason, there was a supply of pikes left over from 1867 sitting in, which were given to some of the porters, you know, one of whom later recorded that he armed himself with a stout black thorn that he'd used in Dublin in 1913 against strikers when he was in the DMP. He later got sacked in the 1920s. But the front gates were closed, and the porters were basically told to go out and look for people who could help come in and defend the campus, you know. Now, they found, see, the thing is, though, like, because the UK was at war and Ireland was part of the UK, there was kind of quite a diverse range of soldiery floating around in the city. So they kind of, various troops, like Anzacs who were on leave in Dublin, ended up in here, you know, South African troops, you know, Imperial or Dominion troops would have been involved in this and were persuaded to come in, because you have to bear in mind, there was a widespread sense that, you know, the Rising was the work of the Germans, or that the Germans were involved in it, you know, which accounts for probably a lot of the post-Rising hostility on the streets, but certainly made it very easy to get various troops in to help defend the campus. So a lot of these Australians and New Zealanders and South Africans ended up on the west front of the university, the bit overlooking College Green where they sat up on the rooftops. Trinity would have had its own officer training corps, the depot of which was down towards the western row end of the campus. So there was a fear, the fear was that perhaps that might be seized by members of De Valera's garrisons as well. So there was an attempt made to secure the college. Now, the thing is, though, it's a rather bizarre ivory tower kind of thing. On the Tuesday, this all happened on Monday. On Tuesday, a lot of students turned up to do their exams. French exams, you know. And their pluckiness and fortitude was rewarded by the rather waspish provost, John Penton Mahaffey, who took them in for dinner in the provost house. A few students ran up on the Wednesday to do the oral examination, but I don't really think they got anywhere. Now, one of them later recorded that they were getting used to the sound of gunfire. Now, there's one thing about the campus that you're in, though, which is, and actually you should say, the cricket pitch was used to bury a couple of bodies in an impromptu fashion, and a couple of hundred yards less from where we're sitting, there's a memorial plaque to a soldier called Arthur Smith, who was briefly buried on the cricket pitch before being interred elsewhere. Now, even aside from all that, you have to bear in mind something about the physical reality of Trinity College. It's smack bang in the city centre. You know, the official name of the university is a College of the Holy and Undivided Trinity near Dublin, because when it was found that it was outside a much, much smaller city, that has since grown around it. And the thing is, though, it's a big patch of ground, 40 acres. And that meant that it was a perfect venue for troops to use, and by the Wednesday of Easter week, members of the Leinster Regiment were basically coming in here setting up shop. Of about 20,000 British troops in Dublin in 1916, about 4,000 of them were garrisoned in Trinity. There's remarkable photographs of the front square covered, not with students or tourists looking for the Book of Kells, but with the paraphernalia of modern war. And there was a little memorial postscript to all this, because after the Rising, stories of looting around in the Rising tend to focus on Sackville Street, you know, as it was then called. But there wasn't really any looting in this part of the world. Grafton Street was unscathed in that sense, as was College Green, which would have been more of a commercial district than it is now. And a lot of the business owners in this part of town felt that the reason why they weren't looted was because Trinity was full of troops and he'd snipers up on the rooftops firing out into the city, you know, and so forth. So there was a committee set up after the Rising to basically put a fund together to thank members of Trinity, of the OTC and the defenders of the campus, and they basically created 6 memorial cups for the defence of Trinity against the Sinn Féin rebellion. The original cups, there was about 6 of them, about that high, but that cost a bit of money, so they did about 70 replicas, which are probably about the size of this. You know, you can see them in there. You can see them in the Proclaimer Republic exhibition in Collins Barracks. They were given out to some of the others. There was at least one guy who had been posted over to the Western Front, an Anzac called McHugh, who had been roped in to persuade it. The thing about McHugh was that he'd been wounded at Gallipoli, or he suffered from disease. He was recuperating in England. He'd come over here on leave. He'd been roped in to help defend the campus. Then he returned to his unit on the Western Front, and sometime in the summer of 1916 he got a letter saying, well, by the way, you're entitled to Memorial Cup for your role in helping defend Trinity College against the Sinn Féiners. So he then wrote back to the college saying that, well, he'd love to attend the award ceremony in the Provost Garden, which coincidentally is very far away from the front line, and he'd really appreciate it. The college would write to his commanding officer saying that his presence was expressly requested at the memorial service. Now, he didn't get off the hook, but he didn't get killed in the Western Front either. He went back to Queensland in 1919, bringing one of those memorial books with him.
Joe, can I bring you in there on Trinity? I mean, how much of a problem was Trinity for the rebel from the insurgent point of view?
Well, certainly, as John says, it was certainly the headquarters of a great many troops and that sort of thing. I don't think that the volunteers and Citizen Army never, to my knowledge, had any plan to take Trinity. I don't think that was there. I think that was one of the problems they had was a complete lack of intelligence at that time. Dublin Castle, the same sort of thing. It wouldn't have been all that difficult to take a newsboy and put him out front and see how many officers were going in and out, and knowing that it was not manned on that day. Ship Street Barracks, all like that, Beggar's Bush Barracks in Trinity as well. I don't think they had any idea. I think that they always felt that Trinity was simply going to be too big with the giant expanse that it was. They could not hold it, they could not take it, and that sort of thing.
And obviously, most people in it would not be sympathetic to their cause.
Absolutely. And so I just think from a point of view that they did that. I would not have taken the same place as they did. I would not have gone anywhere north of the Liffey, tell you the truth, if I were being given the plan, if I were making the plan for this. But the fact of the matter is, I think they could have done better if they had not gone north of Liffey, not taken 1,000 troops, 1,000 volunteers and Citizen Army north of Liffey. They could have done something here, but there really was no chance of them doing anything with Trinity.
Lucy, mentioned Trinity, of course. You've done a bit of work on Elsie Mahaffey, who had a ringside seat for all of this. Maybe just tell us a bit of who was she and what did she report?
Elsie Mahaffey was the daughter of the Provost John Pentland Mahaffey. And by the way, when the first troops arrived on Tuesday morning, I think it was, whoever the general leading them didn't know, had never been to Dublin, didn't have a map of the city, and had to ask the provost of the college, who was a philosopher and classicist, where the streets were, where everything was. He had to defend the city for the Unionists. He just didn't know where anything was. Elsie was the daughter of John Pentland Mahaffey. She was in her 40s. She was unmarried. And she was basically her father's housekeeper. She had a younger sister, but Elsie did most of that work. And she wrote really what is the first account of the Rising. She was the first historian of the Rising. She has a manuscript of about 200 handwritten pages. It's in the collections of Trinity, and it's online, so you can access it and read it in her very legible handwriting. And I will just, let me tell you two funny little things. I mean, she gives an account of everything that happened from the point of view of someone in Trinity, who came to the dinners, a mix of titled people and professors and military people. But my two favorite things to tell you about Elsie. Elsie was a unionist so far to the right that she thought Asquith, the Prime Minister of England, was sympathetic to the rebels. Here's what Elsie was doing when she first heard the news of the Rising. It was Easter Monday, and she had finished her toilette, she said, and she was telling the servants what they could do for the holiday. Each servant had a particular thing. These maids could go to the zoo, and these maids could go here, and the butler would go here, and this other servant had a wedding to go to, but she was giving out those orders to them when her sister came to tell her that the Sinn Feiners had taken the city. So that's one thing, just a little vignette you get of the class structure that she's part of. My other favorite thing is this. On Sunday, the men from Boland's Mill surrendered. They were one of the later garrisons to surrender, and they were marching from Boland's Mill past Trinity to Richmond Barracks, and she looked out and she said that they were a motley crew, very unattractive, but the tall man in front was clearly of a good family, and that was De Valera, of course. And her, what was interesting to me is that there's another diary by a unionist woman that is parallel to this. Her cousin, her first cousin, Leslie Stokes, was in South Dublin, and the same volunteers from Boland Mills had marched by her half an hour earlier, and she said that they were all good looking, especially the man in front. And she said, at first I thought they should all be shot, but then I thought, what a waste of good material. I think it's interesting that, I mean, maybe I was one of the first people to talk about women's comments about how sexy the volunteers were, but they were mostly, the demographic is men under the age of 40, and they left, as Mary mentioned, Kathleen Murphy, they left lots of pregnant women behind them, and here we have two unionist women who are against the Rising, and they're appraising the men from a kind of eugenic point of view, you know, which is a good-looking ones, and will they be good children? So that's just another heretofore unmentioned aspect of the Rising.
Well, Lucy, I'm glad you've come out with all that without me actually asking you the question. It does remind me of Roddy Doyle's fictionalized account, you know, The Star Called Henry, where he talks about, you know, having kind of, you know, uproarious sex in the basement of the GPO with some. The story is very vague. The story at this stage, but I mean, presumably these are people of a certain age, that these issues are still to the fore, as you've
absolutely
just demonstrated.
Yeah, I felt an obligation to set the world right on the issue of the romances, because Yeats says in the famous poem, which many of you will probably never want to hear again, Easter 1916, he describes the rebels as hearts with one purpose alone. And he means the one purpose is revolution. It's not love. They didn't love. They were hardened and like a stone and so forth. But that's actually quite wrong. And there are lots of accounts, not only all the pregnant wives that they left, but also the women's witness statements. I give a wonderful account, and I will just tell you about one series. It's so complex, it's sort of like Midsummer Night's Dream, when X is in love with Y and love and so forth. And that is Annie Cooney, later Annie O'Brien, a member of Cumann na Mban, along with her two sisters. Annie Cooney had a graw, a kind of what we call in America, a crush on Con Colbert, and she modeled her Cumann na Mban uniform on his. He was staying in their house before the Rising, because all the leaders had to stay in places that were not their usual home. And most of her witness statement is about Con Colbert and what he did and so forth. But Con Colbert, according to his sister Lilla's witness statement, obviously he couldn't write his own, he was executed, but his sister said that at a Cayley he went to, he said to her, I want to introduce you to the nicest girl in Dublin. And that was Lucy Smith, who was also a member of Cumann na Mban. But if you read Tom Byrne's witness statement, Tom Byrne, who had been with the fighting with the Boers with McBride earlier. Tom Byrne talks about Lucy Smith, whom he later married. So we have Annie Cooney, who is sort of in love with Con Colbert, who is sort of in love with Lucy Smith, who is being courted by Con Colbert, but really in love with Tom Byrne. And in fact, their surviving child was around yesterday and was written about in the newspaper. If you saw the very old lady with all the medals, that was the daughter of Tom Byrne and Lucy Smith. And there are lots of details about this romance. And then clearly, the volunteers were always going to Cayley's, and they were dancing with women at Cayley's. And the Cayley's were often a cover for a meeting of the leaders, but there was still dancing. And there was a lot of dancing and courtship going on, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And they're going to get league meetings. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of mixed company keeping. I always love that phrase.
It's not just the men and women. You can see that there are radical choices being made by women in relationships as well. Like you have Madeleine French Mullen and Kathleen Lynn meet at the soup kitchen in Liberty Hall in 1913 and spend the rest of their lives together. You have Julia Grennan and Elizabeth O'Farrell, who through their politics spend all of their life together. So there's an awful lot of radicalism going on. They're all young people. They're throwing off the shackles of perhaps conservative ideas of their parents and grandparents. They're making choices. An awful lot of the volunteers and the Cumann na mBan women make choices about marriages, which would before have been matches made by their families. So there are lots of intermarriage. And if you look at the descendants, a lot of them have a volunteer in one garrison and a Cumann na mBan great-grandmother or grandmother in another garrison. Mm-hmm. So you see, and you know, they're young people. It's revolution is in the air, but so is love.
I tell you, I just want to give a kind of a 2-minute warning to the audience. So I'm going to go for questions in a minute because I think we'd be out of here by 6 o'clock. John, could I go to you? And this is something that's provoked a lot of discussion, is the whole question of civilian casualties. What are the figures? I mean, you're talking about, 480 or something overall deaths?
488 confirmed deaths.
Right, and many of those are civilians?
55%.
Okay,
so
okay.
Can't remember the precise breakdown. So the majority of those killed would have been civilians.
And is there any kind of hot spots around the city? I mean, any particular places where most of those deaths occurred?
I mean, a place like Moore Street and, you know, around Shore Street would have seen quite a lot of deaths. I mean, like, these were densely populated areas that would have seen a lot of fighting, bullets coming through walls, intense gunfire and so forth. And there's also the impact in other ways. Like, now it's worth bearing in mind, like, it's difficult to tell who killed who, but I think you can safely say most of the volunteers killed civilians. There's no two ways around that, okay? It's fair to say, though, that probably the majority of civilians were killed by the British. There were more of them. The British would have used far more destructive weaponry and also would have taken a more indiscriminate attitude towards killing people, you know? There's accounts of British soldiers assuming that, you know, basically anyone in a certain district was a Sinn Féiner. Some of them, I mean, some of, you know, General Maxwell's private comments on how to deal with the rebellion are chilling in their severity and completely indiscriminate attitude. Most of the fighting done in the East, done in the Rising, was done by soldiers in British uniforms, okay? That's just the number. So it stands to reason that these far more better trained, better armed soldiers would have killed more. Now, one thing to say about all this as well, though, is the impact of what you might call the legacy of fighting. When Joe Duffy was doing his book, I got an email off him and I thought to myself, "Wow, Joe Duffy sent me an email, you know, like I've arrived." But it was in relation to a guy, a 5-year-old called John Gibney. Now, this was a James Gibney buried up in Glasnevin. See, the bodies were basically scooped up and buried in a mass grave in Glasnevin. I mean, I'm sure some of you may be aware of the concept of Glasnevin's necrology wall being unveiled last week as kind of a record of the rebellion, okay, or a record of the civilian death, of the death toll in totality. But this young Gibney, who was no relation, because I looked into it, his death was put down to cannonade, and he died on the 2nd of May, after the Rising was over. Now, he had an underlying heart condition, and it was from Henrietta Place, very close to North King Street, very close to George Street, very close to an area that would have seen some of the heaviest fighting in the city. So you might look at this unfortunate child as a civilian casualty, but a casualty who came after. And it may well have been the disruption and the upheaval that went on in the city would almost certainly have accounted for some victims as well. So you might say a mixture of things. The fighting, but also the aftermath of the fighting, would have had a knock-on effect in terms of victims and fatalities.
Joe, can I bring you in here? You know, again, somebody with a military background. I mean, if you're issued an order, take no prisoners. Like, that is one of these euphemisms, military euphemisms, you know.
Well, it is, and certainly would have had a far greater effect, I think, in 1916 than it would have today. I think today most officers would not issue an order like that as Maxwell did and as Lowe did and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, most officers on the receiving end would look at it a little bit differently as well. But at that point, yes, they basically said that the reason, particularly the North King Street massacres, where these people were involved, and they didn't stop the rising, so therefore we can kill anybody we want, and that was pretty much it. And Maxwell then, when he was presented with this, he wouldn't bring the British soldiers to bear for it. And as a matter of fact, some of them they had a lineup, but some of them got shipped back to England real quick, so they didn't make the lineup and that sort of thing. That was the order, and Maxwell also said you couldn't handle one of these revolts with velvet glove methods and that sort of thing. I think it points to the mindset of Maxwell, but it also points to the mindset of military at that time. That was an accepted order, if you will, or at least in some cases.
But just to clarify, the order was that if they entered a house where they thought a sniper was operating, that basically they were to treat everyone as a potential enemy and take no prisoners, which was a death sentence.
The men, they didn't kill the men on North King Street.
Yeah. Lucy, you've done a bit of work on the widows of some of these killings.
There was an investigation, and in the North King Street massacres, the British military went to kill anybody in certain buildings. They knew this was Friday of the Rising. They knew there was a sniper in there somewhere, and so they were just going to kill all the men. And they did, very systematically, and the women who survived wrote accounts of it that were incredibly moving, and I put them in my book in the section on emotions, because the women it was very moving, and particularly one man who crawled downstairs bleeding to death, and his wife said, "What did you do?" And he said, "Nothing." And there's another woman meaning he hadn't done anything to deserve that. There was another man who's being marched through holes in the walls between people's flats to where people were who were going to kill him. And he, as he then walks into the flat of a neighboring family, he pretty much says, "Excuse me. I mean, he's sorry to have done that." And the woman says something like, "This is a bad time," or something. And he says to her, "Sometimes the innocent have to suffer with the guilty." And I found that so moving, because he was about to be shot and for no reason, and in this complete chaos, walking through holes in the walls, and he makes this eloquent statement, "Sometimes the innocent have to suffer with the guilty." And this one, you know, sons and fathers and all of them were all shot there. And I should just say, Elsie Mahaffey had heard at lunchtime with the military that they were going to do this, that they were snipers and were going. So I have Elsie Mahaffey's point of view that the military are going out to do something important and heroic, and then you have the widow's accounts also.
Okay, I'm going to go to the audience here. Now, we have a radio mic for members of the audience. So anyone like to ask a question or make a contribution? This is Nina, by the way, a.k.a. the Countess.
Thanks very much. Can I ask about the artillery placed within Trinity? How exactly do they put the guns? And how could they get a field of fire at the GPO? They must have shot them straight up in the air and then back down again.
Well, they brought them outside, but there was a very obvious landmark outside the GPO that's no longer with us. And apparently there were officers spotting from using Nelson's Pillar as a reference point for the shells. So there's one account of an artillery piece at the end of Moore Street. There's another account of an artillery piece on at the bottom of the Lear Street. But they brought them out around the corner to the Lear Street and Tower Street. They weren't fired from the campus, as far as I recall, but they used Nelson's Pillar as the reference point.
But they were also shelling Liberty Hall from there, which was much closer and easier to reach from Trinity.
Mm.
Can I ask a very basic question, please? How many volunteers went out to fight, and how many would have gone out if it hadn't been countermanded?
On Easter Monday, there probably were about 1,200 of volunteer citizen army that went out to fight. And the latest estimates are somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 of volunteers in the city of Dublin, about 10,000 outside the country. We talked about this once on a radio show not too long ago, and the general consensus among us is that, for the most part, those who were going to go out in the Rising probably did so. There were about 2,100 who did go out finally. That was the number of people in the garrisons. And if you look at the people who showed up on Tuesday and even into Wednesday, that sort of thing, If someone was here and wanted to go out and fight in the rising, they probably had the opportunity to do so. And if someone didn't, they didn't do so. When they mustered up, they were given a choice. If you want, you go home. And only one or two would go home, that sort of thing. So it really wasn't a situation where, although we talk about the countermanding order and all the garrisons were undermanned, and they were, and the countermanding order certainly had a great effect upon them, I don't really think that you would have seen all 5,000 come out on Sunday if that countermanding order had not happened. It's my opinion that basically all who wanted to go out pretty much had the opportunity to go out.
The counterman's a great excuse. It's a bit like that line in The Shadow of a Gunman. I would have died for Ireland, only they wouldn't let me. But the military archives, they came up with an estimate about 2,500 people out based on the pension applications for the rising.
And also, with the women, for example, they didn't actually get called out in the same way the Irish Volunteers did on Easter Monday. But in the end, about 300 women made their way to participate in the Easter Rising. So if you did want to be there, you could actually do it. Some of them were cycling in on bicycles from Skerry. Some of them came in from Ashburn. They made their way in. So, you know, if you really, really wanted to be there, you could be there. So I think, you know, I would agree with Joe that all 5,000 wouldn't.
I mean, I think another point is that they didn't have the weapons, because the German weapons never came. If you look at the example of Galway, hundreds of guys mobilised, but they've hardly a shotgun between them. So really, I think what you got was what you were always going to get.
But the plan, though, was for an all-Ireland rising, and there were many messages sent to Cork and Kilkenny and places like that, but for... probably because of all the complicating and contradictory orders, they didn't rise. But Wexford did rise, and the Athenaeum was taken over in the center of Enniscorthy, and there was a small rising there. And Robert Brennan, who was one of the leaders of it, was going to be the next person executed after Sean McDermott and Connolly. But by that point, Asquith said no more. But so there was, you know, Enniscorthy, and then I think Kildare, a few other little places.
Just to add, the rising that was planned would have had the rising in the regions. And for example, in Kerry, where I've done some work, there were a couple of hundred Cumann na Mban women and almost 1,000 Irish volunteers in Tralee and Killarney waiting for orders on Easter Monday. And the order they got was to stand down and await further orders. So the rising that was planned and the rising that happened were two different things. There were other people who did want to participate, but they were not anywhere near the city.
Gentleman here.
Had they not surrendered, given that most of the other folks didn't see action, like except Kent and like Jacob's factory didn't see that much action, had they not surrendered, and we know the reason why they did surrender, because of the civilian casualties and that, how long may have they lasted, in your opinion?
Could I ask you, by the way, what's the medal you have on you there? Just if you don't want me asking.
I've gone to a grand uncle of mine, called the Serious Medal from 1921.
This is later, okay.
See, from a military point of view, and I look at these things, the logistics just wouldn't have allowed them to go on. They did have plenty of ammunition left. That wasn't going to be a problem. As everyone has said here earlier, they were foraging and scrounging for food from the very beginning. That might have turned out to be a problem. Medical supplies or something else could have stopped them. I think that the real problem was, remember, there are a great many places that, although the GPO area, Moore Street and that sort of thing was burned down, Maxwell at one time had said that he would take all things necessary, and he would actually put artillery in the South Dublin Union. So had he done something like that with some of these other places, it would have been very, very difficult to get artillery to go against the Jacobs factory, for example. That would have been very, very tough just to get it in there. But if he started bringing artillery around, I don't see how they could have lasted very long at all. I really don't.
Gentlemen, here.
We were at another talk earlier on, and we were talking about collectments, items.
Could you just repeat that?
Collectibles.
Collectibles, sorry, yes.
In Wadsworth. He brought up, he was showing the proclamations, and then he said, this is very special, proclamation from the king, where the king had signed a document allowing this government to convict the insurgents by not going through a court of law. So the Churchill brother was presenting this aid, said they were planning already to execute the insurgents. So do you know anything about that? That's the first I heard from when I saw that.
Yeah. You want to comment that, Joe? I mean,
it was martial law, so the court martials were held under martial law.
I'm not familiar with it. With a document was signed. I'm sorry, I really quite didn't understand. This document supposedly was signed before the rising or something, or was signed before the executions.
The judgment in the Trust Whites in White
auctioneers
He was giving a talk, and he had a screen, and he had all these. He had them up on the screen, showing off all the different pieces, and then he came across. He had this one. He brought it up. So I was just wondering. We were rushing to come down here, so we didn't get a chance to ask.
I'm sorry.
Well, I tell you what, it seems to me that the only document you'd need to convict any of the insurgents is the proclamation, because it refers to, you know, gallant allies in Europe. So it's immediately, automatically a treasonous document.
He had it written on a proclamation from the king, and then there was
we can move on from this.
Yeah.
No. Anybody else want to come in here? Yeah, just gentlemen over here. Yeah.
There may be a confusion with this proclamation. Maxwell himself issued a proclamation when he arrived here on Friday morning. And in the proclamation, you know, he said that if people don't hand up their guns, etc., he's willing to blow up, you know. But the martial law, the courts afterwards, or field general court martials, just had three people on the. There was three army officers around the court martial, and they were held. Two of them held in other. There was two court martials in Richmond Barracks, and one of the officers, that was in charge of one of them was Brigadier General Blackadder. So that name was around at that time. But they were convicted under the Defence of the Realm Act, not under court martial. Or on the martial law, as long as the defense of the realm, the charge will be made. And really, the charge basically was assisting the enemy.
I'm getting the 1 minute warning here from our hosts.
Okay.
Gentlemen here. By the way, any women want to? Mary's very concerned. But yes,
yes,
I think we'll have a.
Gender quotas.
Yes, we're. No, sorry, could you. Yeah. Yeah, we'll go for. Yeah, we just go for the. Yes, and we'll come back to you next, right?
Can I just say that I think sometimes assumptions can be made by looking back with modern eyes, not seeing things in context. And there's so many examples of that. Just a little minor example of that would be, I've heard so many times it been said, you know, devil urged without women into about women's mills. Now that's only one example. But it said like a full stop then, as if De Valera were anti-war and he didn't want any women here. Whereas I think that it's far more likely that De Valera was a man typical of his age, who was who had this kind of patriarchal view of women, that they were to be protected, and that a place of comfort was not a place for them to be. And that's why I feel sometimes. You know, we all admire all the women who were brave enough to take part in the activities then. But it was in context. It was very unlikely that a lot of the men would have wanted the women to be in a dangerous situation.
Yeah.
And that would have been the reason why. It wasn't just that they were being anti-women.
Anybody want to comment?
Yeah, okay. Well, the quotation I read from Leslie Price says exactly that. She says, you know, the volunteers, the kind of men they were, they thought we should be away from all that danger. So chivalry was certainly a great obstacle to women who wanted to be fully involved. It doesn't mean they didn't like women, it just meant they were so chivalrous they didn't want them to contribute. Somewhere in this book, if you look at, in the index under De Valera, I quote exactly what he says when he was questioned about that, about how he only wanted trained soldiers and he thought the women weren't trained soldiers. So that's the answer to that.
I just have one more question here from this gentleman. And because we're
my question is relating to the military side, but just in terms of the De Valera issue there, it's like, I think if you look at his subsequent performance and his attitude to women, maybe it wasn't actually as benign as you said.
True.
But the point I was just going to make was that in terms of the rebellion itself, I heard an interesting idea earlier on today that had they held out for longer, the bringing of America into the First World War might have been much more difficult, and therefore they could have actually secured much better terms than they even eventually ended up 5 or 6 years later. So when it was down to the question then is, were they very military incompetent? And one of the questions that I have about that is, how come the guns that were coming from Germany were coming so late? You wouldn't have been able to, even with TNT, I would have thought around today, or DHL, get them distributed all around the country for a nationwide rising. So was it just one blunder after another? And that it wasn't quite as desperate a case, that they might actually succeed in getting an awful lot more because of the effect it would have had in terms of America being brought into the war. So it wasn't utterly foolhardy, but they just went about it very, very badly.
Let me give it, there's kind of a two-part answer here. I can try and do it very quickly because I know we're running out of time. With regard to America coming into war, you must understand that at that time America was still trying to stay quote-unquote neutral, although they weren't exactly. But also the President of the United States was Woodrow Wilson, who was very much an Anglophile, and I think that he did everything he could. And his performance at the peace conference thereafter, not seeing Irish people and that sort of thing, I don't think he was going to bring America in on the side. I don't think he was going to bring much pressure to bear on Britain or anything else at that time. I really don't think so. I think there's a misconception that there was a huge Irish political force in America at that time, and I don't think that's correct either. Certainly in New York or Boston or something else it would have been, but not overall. The second part of your question with regard to bringing the arms, I have an opinion, and perhaps it is just an opinion, but my opinion is that was so poor, that really was very difficult. If you think just about the logistics again of that, if you got 200 tons of this material that's coming off the vessel there, do we have the ability to get it off the vessel? Do we have the ability to move it all the way around? If it's coming in the night before, you're going to put it, you've only got 10,000 volunteers anyway. You put 20,000 weapons out there, you put them in the hands of people who have never held a weapon before. Does this really make any sense from a military point of view? Now, this is an opinion which others don't share, obviously, but from a military point of view, I sure as heck would not want to go into any kind of an operation with people who had never seen a weapon before and had it put in their hands the night before. And if you compare the landing in Larne earlier with 25,000 weapons and the proposed landing of the Outer with 20,000 weapons, you know, Larne had so many more cars going back and forth and around, just depositing them in dumps. I don't think that was really a possible thing. I think that the plan was so poorly planned that it really wasn't a plan itself. But as I say, that's my opinion, and I know others just disagree with it.
No, tell you guys, I'm going to have a wrap up here, right? The clock has beaten us again. Just one last thought, because I did stick my head in some of the earlier presentations, and spare a thought for the poor old animals in Dublin Zoo, because apparently they face a food crisis as well.
Yeah.
And their prize attractions were, of course, the higher, you know, the lions, the tigers, and so on, right? So the poor old people, the poor old animals lower down the food chain, they were slaughtered and fed to the lions and tigers, sort of a Darwinian moment. Listen, we're going to have to wrap up here because I don't abuse the hospitality of our hosts here in Trinity College. Some future head schools. The next one in Glasnevin Visitor Centre on Sunday, the 10th of April. That's at 2 p.m. John Gibney will be back on the panel along with Connor Dodd, Liz Gillis, and Joe Duffy. Another one on the 28th of April. Why should we commemorate 1916? Oh no, you can't go to that one because that's in Wheatfield Prison. Sorry. Maybe I will see some of you there. That'll be an interesting one. And finally, a third one on the 7th of May, starting at 2 o'clock on Palmerston Place, Dublin 7. That's the street where I live. We're having a 1916 on our street, a series of papers, including by John Gibney and by Mary. They'll be there, and we're going to wrap it up at another head school just like this one. So you're all invited, a cup of tea in my place, 7th of May, Saturday the 7th of May. So I'd just like to thank everybody here, the organisers of this, RTE. I think they've done a marvellous job, absolutely fantastic event throughout the whole city. I'd just like to thank Mary McAuliffe, John Gibney, Lucy McDermott, and Joe Connell, and you, the audience, and in particular those who participated in the discussion. Thank you very much.